Hi, everybody. This is Jeff from Good News Gathering, and welcome to another one of our weekly podcasts based on our year-long Bible reading initiative. I'm so glad that you're joining us today, and my hope and prayer is that you're staying engaged with the daily readings and learning things you never knew before. But more importantly than just learning facts from the Bible, my prayer is that your faith is growing. You're hearing God's voice through the readings, and that the readings are helping to mold and shape how you view the world and how you live your life. You see, the bottom line is this. When G&G's leadership team made the decision to focus in 2017 on daily Bible reading and helping our people develop a biblical worldview, the goal was not to produce Bible scholars. Now, obviously, there's nothing wrong with being a Bible scholar, but that wasn't the goal. The goal wasn't to simply increase our attendance by increasing people's connection with G&G through the daily readings or the weekly podcasts. Clearly, we'd love to reach as many people as possible and increase the number of people who get connected to Jesus Christ through Good News Gathering. But our goal wasn't about attendance numbers. The goal, simply put, was life change. Our hope was that the Bible reading plan, the explanatory videos, and the podcast would produce life change. That each person who engaged in this process would become more and more like Jesus Christ through this process. We've seen the studies. We know that daily engagement with and reflection upon God's Word plays a crucial role in a person's spiritual growth. And I understand, some people simply don't like to read. I've had people say that to me. But friends, there are Bible reading apps that will read it to you. So when you're in your car or you're at home, you can listen to God's Word. If you have any questions about that, call the church office and JD or Doug Puckett can walk you through to access those. Now, if you're keeping up with the daily readings, you finished 1 Samuel and you're nearing the end of 2 Samuel. These are exciting, action-packed books. And as I mentioned briefly last week, I love these books because they are loaded with leadership principles and tons of examples of both good and bad leadership. These books are a primer on the subject of leadership. And I want to begin today by noting that as we move from the book of Judges to the book of 1 Samuel, the Israelite nation is undergoing a dramatic governmental change. As you may recall, after the conquest of the Promised Land, each of the 12 tribes of Israel set about driving out the remaining Canaanites and settling their particular tribal areas. There was no central government, no capital city, no standing army for defense. The Israelites were a loose confederation of independent tribes that may or may not band together against a common enemy. There was no recognized leader or leading tribe. In fact, it appears that the form of government after the death of Joshua was to be what scholars refer to as a theocracy. That is, God himself was supposed to be the direct ruler of the nation. But the people failed to stay focused on God. Repeatedly, they fell into the worship of other gods, the gods of the inhabitants that they failed to drive out, which explains why God was so specific in his instruction that they should drive them out. Because of their failure to follow God, the tribe struggled in a state of anarchy at times, which included oppression by foreign enemies and civil war among the tribes. See Judges chapters 19 and 20, in which the tribe of Benjamin is nearly wiped out by the other tribes. At various times throughout the 300 to 350 year period of the Judges, God would raise up a judge from different tribes to lead the people. Now, we tend to think of a judge as a person in a black robe who sits in a courtroom and dispenses justice, handing down sentences for criminal conduct or settling disputes between people. And while the Old Testament judges may have done some of that, I mean, it's clear that Deborah did that in Judges 4, verse 5, it probably is accurate to think of them as much as warlords. They rallied the people to fight against different groups like the Midianites, the Moabites, or the Amorites. These were difficult and brutal times. But as we move into 1 Samuel, we encounter a pivotal character in Israel's history. Samuel is the last of the judges, and God uses him to transition the Israelites from a confederation to a monarchy, from a loose association of tribes to a central government led by a king. Samuel is called by God at a dark time in Israel's history. Israel suffers a devastating defeat at the hands of the Philistines, and the Ark of the Covenant, the most holy object in the religion of the Israelites, is captured by the Philistines. But Samuel rallies the people. They fast and pray, asking God to forgive their sins. And God throws the Philistine army into a panic. The Israelites rout the Philistines, and order is restored. In fact, 1 Samuel 7, verses 13 through 15 says, "So the Philistines were subdued, and they stopped invading Israel's territory. Throughout Samuel's lifetime, the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines. The towns from Ekron to Gath that the Philistines had captured from Israel were restored to Israel, and Israel delivered the neighboring territory from the hands of the Philistines. And there was peace between Israel and the Amorites." Now, it sounds to me like Samuel was a great success, and in many ways he was. But Samuel failed to grasp the first leadership principle that I want to talk about today. And it goes like this. There is no success without a successor. Let me repeat that. There is no success without a successor. Great leaders are so focused on ensuring the success of the organization, the company, the school, the church, the ministry, or whatever it is they're involved in, that they intentionally devise a succession plan. In other words, they deliberately plan for the continued success of the organization in the event they are no longer able to lead. At this, Samuel failed miserably. Notice what it says in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. It says this: "When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as Israel's leaders. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not follow his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice." Now the problem begins in verse 1. It says Samuel appointed his sons as judges. Nowhere in the book of Judges does a judge appoint one of his or her own children to be a judge. God raised up the judges as the need arose and the people cried out to God for help. The judges God raised up could come from any one of the tribes, but there was no sense of hereditary succession. But here, Samuel appoints his own sons as judges, and it's apparent that Samuel was blind to both their character and their competence as leaders. So the elders of Israel, the leaders of the various tribes, approach Samuel and ask him to appoint a king. Samuel prays for guidance, and God's response is fascinating. He says in 1 Samuel 8, 7, he says, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king." You see, the people wanted a king, thinking that a new system of government would bring about a change in the nation. The problem was their struggles as a nation were driven by their failure to obey God. A different form of government would not change this. What they needed was a unified faith, not a unified central government. Israel had experienced periods of success under different judges from different tribes so long as their focus was on God. In reality, it was never about the judge. As we read about judges like Gideon or Jephthah or Samson, these judges were just as flawed and imperfect as everybody else. It was always about God and the nation's reliance upon Him. But the people failed to grasp this truth. They thought having a king and a centralized government would make the difference. Unfortunately, without a unified faith, any form of government is doomed to fail. We are watching this truth play out in America today. We lack a unified faith, and yet we wonder why our country is divided. Our government appears incapable of moving forward, and each faction lacks any concept of the common good. We seem to believe that some new piece of legislation, or one more government program, or more money will solve our country's problems. And the sad truth is, without a unified and unifying faith, America will be no more successful than the Israel of the Old Testament. After warning the people in no uncertain terms about the perils of monarchy, Samuel is directed by God to anoint Saul as Israel's king. And this brings us to the second leadership principle that I want to cover today. In his book, Good to Great, business leadership guru Jim Collins examines the qualities of great leaders in the corporate world. What he learned in the corporate world applies equally well in families, schools, small businesses, civic organizations, ministries, and churches. Much to his surprise, Collins discovered that the greatest leaders in the corporate world were not highly charismatic, larger-than-life saviors with big personalities. Rather, the greatest leaders were individuals who possessed a rare blend of extreme personal humility with intense professional will. They tended to be self-effacing individuals who displayed fierce resolve to do whatever needed to be done to make their company great. The greatest leaders, he found, are a study in duality. They're modest, yet willful. Humble, yet fearless. And at first blush, Saul appears to have the makings of a great leader. In 1 Samuel chapter 10, Samuel anoints Saul in a private ceremony as the king of Israel. But Saul tells no one. Even when his uncle asks him directly about his conversation with Samuel, Saul never mentions what Samuel said about kingship. Then Samuel summons the people together and declares Saul to be God's chosen king. But Saul is hiding among the baggage, apparently reluctant to push himself forward as the people's leader. So he appears to possess the humility needed for greatness. In his first act as king, he calls the people to rescue the city of Jabesh-Gilead from the Ammonites. It's a brilliant victory, fueled by Saul's bold stroke of calling out all of the tribes with a threat of retribution on any tribe that would fail to respond to the call. It's a risky move that saves the city and solidifies his kingship. And in victory, Saul displays uncommon grace toward those who originally objected to his kingship. So he appears to possess the intense resolve to do whatever needed to be done to make Israel great. But appearances can be deceiving. Beginning in 1 Samuel chapter 13, Saul embarks upon a series of decisions that demonstrate that over time his pride outweighed his humility. And his intense resolve was not focused on doing whatever needed to be done to make Israel great. His intense resolve focused on himself, his fame, and his retention of power. In chapter 13, he assumes the role of priest and offers a sacrifice in Samuel's absence, something he was not permitted to do. In chapter 14, he issues a rash order for his troops not to eat any food until the end of the day of battle. His own son, Jonathan, whose heroism in the battle is known to all, is unaware of the order, and so he eats something. But Saul is so incensed that his order is disobeyed that he intends to execute his own son. Jonathan is spared due to the intervention of the troops. In chapter 15, Saul disobeys a direct order from Samuel regarding the defeated Amalekite king and the spoils of war. In chapter 16, we're introduced to David, the man who would be the next king of Israel, and for the remainder of 1 Samuel, we see Saul's jealousy of David grow to the point that he makes repeated attempts to kill David. And finally, in chapter 28, in an act that manifests just how far Saul had drifted away from God, Saul consults a witch, an act strictly forbidden by the Mosaic law in Exodus 22:18, Leviticus 19:31, and Leviticus 26. Saul's life ends tragically in suicide. It's a sad ending for a man who began with so much promise. But there's a brief reference in 1 Samuel 15 that clearly indicates that if Saul ever possessed the humility needed for greatness, he lost it somewhere along the way. Perhaps power went to his head. Perhaps he began to see himself as the king rather than as a follower of God and a servant of the people who simply held the role of king for a time. The reference is so brief, it's easy to overlook, but it's 1 Samuel 15, verse 12, and it reads as follows. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but he was told, Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor and has turned and gone on down to Gilgal. Did you catch that? Saul goes to Carmel to set up a monument to who? To himself. Not to God for giving him a victory over the Amalekites, but to himself. As if he achieved this victory through his own mighty power. And then the rest of the verse reads, and has turned and gone on down to Gilgal. Now, some scholars believe the Hebrew wording used here may indicate that Saul marched into Gilgal in a triumphal procession, the conquering hero, perhaps even with the conquered Amalekite king Agag marching in chains in the parade. How sad. Saul goes from self-centeredness and self-promotion to suicide. Now, with the defeat of the Israelite army by the Philistines and the death of King Saul and three of his sons, the nation of Israel plunged into turmoil. David had already been anointed by Samuel as Israel's next king, but Samuel was dead. And David's anointing may not have been witnessed by anyone outside of his immediate family. Though the Philistines were nominally in charge of the whole country, Saul's commander Abner sets up Saul's remaining son, as king on the east side of the Jordan River. David was made king of the tribe of Judah in the south. After the death of Abner, Saul's son is assassinated and David becomes king of all Israel. David becomes one of the most important figures of the Bible. Before his reign, Israel was defeated. They were a vassal people. Within a few years, David had freed Israel from foreign oppression and extended Israel's control over some small neighboring peoples. Before his reign, there was no one dominant political or religious center in Israel. But within a few years, his new capital city of Jerusalem assumed that role, and it continues in that role to this very day. Prior to David, no leader had established a dynasty. David established a dynasty that lasted around 400 years after his death and provided the backdrop for the coming of a future ideal king, the King of Kings. David defeats Israel's enemies, secures her borders, expands her influence, and brings the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem, where he hopes one day to erect a temple. He is a man after God's own heart. And yet the Bible does not present him as a Superman. He is an extremely brave and shrewd soldier who could command the absolute loyalty of outstandingly brave and capable warriors. Yet his performance as a king and a father was characterized by self-indulgence and vacillation. He appears to have been unable to inspire in his immediate family and his people the devotion he earned from his comrades in arms. I sometimes wonder if David wasn't far more comfortable on the battlefront with his band of mighty men than he was at home dealing with the intrigues of a royal family, the affairs of state, and presiding over peace. And that brings me to the third leadership principle. We find it illuminated in David's adultery with Bathsheba and the subsequent murder of her husband. And it goes like this. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Let me repeat that. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great leaders surround themselves with people who are truth tellers, people who can tell them no, people who can hold them accountable. David lacked this. Perhaps his success left those around him dazzled by his apparent brilliance. Perhaps as his power grew, others became afraid to question him or be honest with him. 2 Samuel 11:3-4 indicate that David sent someone to find out who the woman was that he had seen from the roof of his palace. The man identified her. Then David sent messengers to get her. It appears they may have even brought her back to the palace. But no one questions him. No one asks, why? Why are you doing this? Don't you know who she is? She's the wife of Uriah, one of your most trusted warriors, your 30 mighty men. Nobody says, stop. Think about what you're doing. Then to cover up his sin, David sends a letter to his commander Joab, telling him to arrange the death of Uriah. Joab never questions the order. Joab never asks why. He simply carries it out, and Uriah dies. The prophet Nathan later confronts David with his sin, but by then it's too late. The damage is done. And even though David repents and finds forgiveness, his life is plagued by the consequences of his actions. Bathsheba's child dies at birth. One of his sons forcibly rapes one of his daughters. That son is then murdered by her brother. David's son Absalom conspires to overthrow him as king, leading a rebellion that causes a civil war and ends in Absalom's death. It's a tragic end to a reign that began with such promise. Friends, that's why we've created the expectation here at Good News Gathering that everyone who calls GNG their church home should be involved in a life group or a task group. It's critical that we all have a small circle of close Christian friends who know us as we really are. People who know our strengths and our weaknesses. People who can ask us the tough questions and tell us the tough truths. People who can look us in the eye and say the one word that none of us likes to hear, but the one word we all need to hear, the word no. You know, if we surround ourselves with Christian truth tellers, perhaps, unlike David, we can finish the race laid out before us strong. Friends, until next week, think biblically, think logically, and think honestly.